Hi, my name is Bob Sander, and I'm a professional storyteller. For over 30 years, my repertoire has included a group of personal narrative stories. Some of these are childhood memories, stories lived when, well, basically when I was a knucklehead in training, so to speak. Other stories come from my college student era, and still others date from my time as a beginner parent. And you know, by then I was kind of a professional knucklehead. While I do tell personal tales that are, well, either too risque or too this or too that to include here, you know, if you come to dinner some night, we'll eat and drink and I'll spill the beans on all those stories. But this collection, this bunch makes the cut. So I hope you enjoy them. And as for truthfulness, well, just know that these stories are absolutely 100% as true as I can make them. Enjoy. Most adults remember teachers from childhood in two broad categories, the good ones and the bad ones. And what do we base these judgments upon? Well, often it's no more than this. It's the opinions we formed as six-year-olds, still echoing down the decades. Unfortunately, children's opinions are formed using highly unsophisticated measuring sticks. Her teeth are funny. Or, she likes Cheryl better than me. Or, my pencil always breaks in her room, and once I had a bloody nose. Any one of these things might be sufficient for a child to remember a teacher as bad. Equally appalling, I found a quarter by her blackboard. Or, she likes peas and I do too. And that might earn the good teacher label. Kids are like that. You know what I'm talking about. Or maybe not. Maybe that was just me. But now that you've got my sterling set of teacher criteria, let me tell you about my most favorite teacher and why I liked her so much. Surely kids today are going to envy me when I report that school in the 1950s did not begin until after Labor Day, much later than the current craze for early August. The high heat of summer was still a very potent force in our non-air-conditioned world. Parents were always willing to squeeze in a last, long weekend at a neighborhood pool, or perhaps a nearby lake, before descending into the tyranny of the school year schedule. As if it were a trained animal, cool weather was supposed to understand it was obligated to arrive on the Monday that school started, and it rarely obliged. The September I began elementary school, Monday morning was still very warm. But my mother was having none of that. She was certain fall, or who knows, maybe even winter would come by midday. She bundled me in several layers, including a coat and a hat. I was sweltering before we even went out the door. You always get colds. Doc Ray doesn't need any more of our money. Let's be on the safe side, shall we? You want to be on the safe side, don't you? Now stay right here while I get ready. It had taken me so long to get layered up that I had missed the bus. So now she had to drive me to school. The safe side. The safe side. I pondered this new phrase with all of the reasoning power and literal-mindedness of an imaginative six-year-old. The living room couch where she set me down to wait for her was evidently the safe side. If this was safe, I wanted to go to the other side, the dangerous side. The kitchen might be the dangerous side. It was certainly the cooler side, especially if you stood in front of the refrigerator and opened the doors. Close that door. You can't be hungry already. You just ate breakfast. Besides, money just flies out that open door, you know. Really? I labored over this new puzzle. Money flying out of the refrigerator. As she trundled me out to the car. Let's go. Maybe we'll beat the bus. Nah. No such luck. It arrived well before we did. Instead, I was the last person to walk into my first grade class. Everyone else was already seated. My mother mortified me with a kiss in the doorway. Then she winked at the teacher and she was out of there, gone. Kids snickered at that, you know. Or perhaps it was because of the way I was dressed. Nobody else had worn a coat or a hat on a day like this. But the laughter was quickly upstaged by a series of little sounds. It was kind of like bird song or water trickling over a ripple in a stream. Everyone got quiet and listened. "You must be Bobby." The soft sounds burbled out of a pixie-ish little woman scarcely taller than me. It was our teacher, Miss Norwood. The corners of her eyes crinkled kindly when she smiled. Frizzy hair, floral print dress, she looked like a little doll come to life. Her voice continued to trickle out.
"We're so glad you're here, aren't we, class? We're all present now. Our day of learning can begin."
The force of her Tinkerbell persona mesmerized us. Miss Norwood suggested I take off my coat and my hat and hang them up. I was only too happy to oblige. A long wooden rack stretched across the entire back wall of the room just for this purpose. You've seen that kind of rack that I'm talking about, you know? It's like they've got those hooks screwed onto the bottom side, and you hang your coat up by that little loop on the inside of your coat collar. I put my coat up on one of those hooks. I would have put my hat right up there beside it, but instead, something distracted me. I noticed the top side of the shelf. It was entirely open except for one thing. There was a large poster board. It was leaning upright against the wall, small, hand-drawn cards numbering from 1 to 100 were carefully inserted into perfectly cut little slits in that poster board, 10 slits across, 10 rows going down. It was the building blocks of arithmetic and all of mathematics, marching row by row, an ordered cascade of numbers. It was just inspiring to see them all together like that. For reasons I cannot entirely explain, now or then, to place my hat up there with those marching numbers suddenly seemed very important. Likely, I thought this would demonstrate to Miss Norwood how much I loved numbers. Or maybe it would somehow show how eager I was to be here, starting school, which, of course, I hadn't been only minutes before. In any case, the shelf was too high for me to reach. Huh. Could this be an opportunity to display my newfound love for math and numbers and show off some physical dexterity at the same time? Oh, yes. I elected to toss my hat onto the shelf. With a rapid flick once around my index finger, followed by a jaunty fling release, I'd let my hat fly. While my motivation was well-directed, my aim was not. That much was apparent as soon as the hat left my hand. Meant to fly skillfully beside the grand sweep of digits, instead it smacked into the poster board with amazing power. The board seemed to come to life. It lurched forward. Flew forward might be a better description. Little number cards exploded from their nests like birds in search of worms, each in a different direction. Tiny number 6, number 53, 14, 27, 98, they all fluttered everywhere about the room. I had only meant to identify myself with the majesty of the world's numbers. Via my hat, I know it's a novel approach. Instead, I had unleashed chaos and disorder for the second time in less than 3 minutes. I was mortified, and the class roared with laughter. You know, a lesser teacher might have judged right away that I was not destined to be a stellar pupil, or at worst, interpreted my brilliant move as malicious. But not Miss Norwood. She always gave the benefit of the doubt. She never reacted until she had taken the time to listen and delve into your story. And again, she quelled all that raucous laughter with her music box voice.
"What a wonderful opportunity. Let's see which row of students can find and place the most numbers back in the correct slots the fastest. Each group gets 1 minute. Row 1, get ready. You're looking for numbers 1 through 10. On your mark, get set."
Brilliant. My inexplicable act was suddenly transformed. Evidently, I'd been the brains that inspired a totally new sport. I even received some admiring looks. All attention focused on the first row students as they scanned the floor for the missing numbers. Other kids cheered them on. Miss Norwood escorted me to my seat.
The numbers certainly flew the coop, didn't they?
Yes, Miss Norwood, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to knock them down. I like numbers. That's why I wanted my hat to be up there.
Now, spoken out loud, this sounded a lot less logical than I would have wished.
Of course, Bobby. Anyone could see that. But next time you wear a hat to school, I can put it up on this shelf for you, if you'd like.
You know, if she had asked me to put lit firecrackers in my nostrils, I'd have agreed just as happily with the same idiotic grin on my face. I remember thinking two things. One, she'll be my favorite teacher. And two, I'll never get in trouble like that again. And you know, I didn't. Instead, I always got into the kind of trouble that a normal person just can't create, not consciously. Real, layered, nuanced trouble, that's virtually a work of art. It can't be fully and rationally explained, but it always makes a tremendous impact. I seem to have a talent for that kind of trouble. Let me give you an example. It was almost Christmas. A week before school let out for break, Miss Norwood suggested we play a game the following Monday.
It's called Show and Tell, she said. Bring something to class that you find particularly interesting.
Tinkle, tinkle. Oh, that chime-like little voice. We were her willing slaves. If she had said, bring the Pope, bound and gagged, we would have done it very gladly.
It can be anything at all. It'll just be fun to see it and talk about it, whatever it is.
Hints of winter had been with us for months, but still no big snowfall or really cold weather. Fall was hanging on. Saturday was warm enough for me to visit my favorite place, the Ninth Street Woods. The route to the woods passed through a weedy field. In it, straight woody stalks of some now dormant plants stood, stabbing the air. They no longer held any foliage, except for one thing. Just below the tops of those many barren stems, I spied small, nearly round, gray, papery balls. And they weren't balls, of course. I had no clue what they actually were. Touching one produced no ill effect. I even liked the feel of the rough, raspy, cardboard-like material. I broke off a stalk and held it in my hand. All the weight seemed to be in the stalk. Paper balls themselves were insubstantial, weightless. Little grooves crisscrossed the surfaces. How interesting, I thought. I saw no need to look any further. These were the most interesting thing you could find anywhere. Plus, there were so many of them. So I picked 50. My mother was cooking when I got home. She asked me about them.
What are those?
I don't know. What do they do?
I don't know. Nothing, I guess.
Are those for show and tell?
Yep.
Well, what are you going to say about them? My mother knew how to drain a can full of fun in record time.
It's a secret.
I bet, she said, and went back to making dinner. Monday arrived. The time came for the class to play show and tell. Kids showed off their haul with the usual amount of careful forethought, which is to say, not much. Most had forgotten the assignment until late Sunday night. Others only remembered it the last second on the way to school. Marky, the biggest kid in our block, was just such a one. Thinking quickly, he'd pried a rock loose from his father's garden wall just before the bus came, and now he showed it to us proudly.
It's very shiny,
Miss Norwood intoned in her butter-sweet voice.
It's from my dad's garden wall, he confessed. He was just beaming. At first it was stuck, but I hammered it out. He's going to tan my hide.
Marky said this with pure pleasure in his voice. He was proud of the audacity of what he had done. We beamed back at him, truly. It was an inspired act. Any kid would approve. Carol Ann brought in her grandmother's doll. It was ancient and headless. She explained that her dog had eaten the head, and now the poor beast could not go poo-poo. Stephen brought in a tennis ball he found in the weeds near the tennis courts at the city park.
I didn't steal it. It was there a long time. I know that 'cause a worm was living in a hole in the ball.
He pointed at the wormhole.
See right here. My mother made me leave the worm in a jar in my bedroom. I'll probably put him back in when I get home.
We agreed the worm must be put back in. It probably missed its rotten tennis ball condominium. But not bringing the worm to class was the bigger disappointment. We boys exchanged looks and silent shrugs. We all thought the same thing. You can't have everything. After each item, Miss Norwood smiled and urged the class to applaud. Then she directed us where to put our wondrous, growing menagerie. Just as the coat rack ran the length of the back wall, our room also had a deep, room-length, waist-high shelf with windows above its whole length. It ran the length of our one outside wall. Our growing train of paraphernalia snaked along the top of it. We were nearly done.
Remember, children, said Miss Norwood, put everything in a line on the window shelves.
She said this to each and every child before and after he or she stood in front of the class. This was for the simple reason that each child instantly forgot that directive as soon as they heard it, public speaking being a high-anxiety experience for kids and adults, I might add. I made a special resolve. I would not forget. Well, I was the last one to present, which that suited me just fine. My mother's question, "What are you going to say?" was still on my mind. So was my answer to her.
"It's a secret."
Even at that last moment, as I walked to the front of the room with my handful of weed stalks, what I was going to say was still pretty much a secret, especially to me. I harbored a blind faith that inspiring tidbits of riveting information would just stream out of my mouth. As I was about to find out, blind faith is usually as unfounded as it is unrewarded.
"What are those, Bobby?"
The little man inside my speech center was out to lunch at that particular moment. Silence reigned supreme. Finally, I produced a phrase.
I don't know.
Okay. What do they do?
26 pairs of eyeballs drilled holes straight through me. A palm full of mysterious sticks shook in my hand. It was unnerving. I prayed no hitherto unsuspected bathroom event would occur inadvertently.
I don't know.
Another 30-second silent span ticked on, during which an entire year seemed to pass. The class regarded the idiot in front of them. In fairness, I was not the only speaker who struggled for words that day. I was merely the one who achieved it in such full measure.
Well, I must say, they look very interesting, don't they, class?
Tinkle, tinkle. Heads nodded. She could not be denied. I stumbled back to my seat, weedy unknowns in my hand.
Bobby, will you please put them on the shelf by the windows?
Of course, I'd forgotten to put them on the shelf. Like everyone else, my ability to remember anything was reduced to jello by the awful occasion of speaking in front of a group. And this happened regardless of my firm resolve and despite the fact that my presentation only required a vocabulary of 3 words, or 6 if repeating counts, or 8 if you count contractions as 2 words. I'm reaching here, I know. At day's end, we boarded the bus for the usual pandemonium trip home, spiced with the gleeful knowledge that Christmas was just around the corner. The humdrum of school routine would be switched into the off position for at least 2 full weeks. Meanwhile, back in the darkened schoolroom, my contribution to the motley show-and-tell assortment was anything but switched off. While whole stories of many flavors occurred over Christmas break, let's skip them all, which in itself is a true approximation of every kid's Christmas break experience, i.e. too fast, and let's head back to Miss Norwood's classroom. As we re-entered school, we were all intercepted at the main door and told to assemble in the gymnasium. Our principal, Mr. Noble, wanted to address the entire school body. This, I learned, was his traditional greeting. In one fell swoop, he designed to welcome us back and remind us of his awesome presence. I used the word awesome in its earlier, more religious connotation, as in humbled with fear.
Have a nice Christmas, everyone.
His voice conveyed the unmistakable crackle of lightning. It forked from the ancient PA and passed through us like electricity, and not the good coming down a roller coaster kind. It was more like the screwdriver in the electrical socket type. Like cued robots, we intoned, "Yes, Mr. Noble."
"Good. Remember, Christmas is over. It's now time to direct our minds where they're supposed to be. Focused on learning. In this school, my school, students do not exhibit wild behavior or silliness. Learning is serious business. Buckle down, save your loud voice for the playground, and go forth, scholars. Let us not meet under unpleasant circumstances."
"Yes, Mr. Noble."
Short, stocky, muscled like a professional wrestler, Mr. Noble's build could not be obscured. His daily white button-down dress shirt with the rolled-up sleeves and tie, black creased slacks, polished leather dress shoes all said professional, but his coiled, springy, muscular stride and steely gray blue eyes said, "Watch out." We watched out. Only one thing spoiled Mr. Noble's imposing mien: his bald head. He was not thin on top. He was not lightly ringed with the skirt of male pattern baldness. He was totally, boldly, unquestionably bald. The light that shone upon his head mirrored and reflected with breathtaking force. Kids being kids, a nickname had emerged, and it had passed down long before my arrival. I learned it soon enough. Chrome Dome, or as older kids put it on the playground, Principal Noble's Noble Dome of Chrome, or just Dome of Chrome, for short, or shorter still, DC. Of course, I had no idea chrome was a shiny metal on car bumpers, or that a dome was an architectural form. That didn't matter. I was happy to repeat the phrase with all the titillating pleasure that comes from perfect ignorance. We exited the gym, youngest first, meaning us. We kept in neat straight lines and maintained absolute silence. And why was that?
Tinkle, tinkle.
Because Miss Norwood asked us to do so. We arrived at our classroom and came to a halt before the door.
Here at last! Oh, just look at that door, children!
We looked at the door. Yep, that was our door, all right. Closed and locked, lights still off. Same as when we left it. Every other room had been washed, floors stripped and waxed, cleaned top to bottom, but not ours. The school janitor, Mr. McKinney, had come down with flu and gone home to bed. Figured he would do our room when he had returned.
"It's not just a door now, is it? It's a portal, a passageway. It's the path to learning. Through that door and others to come, your future awaits you. Enter it with care and respect."
Momentarily, Miss Norwood's words would prove eerily prophetic.
"Marky, here is the key. Please open the door and lead the way."
How Marky rated that honor, I'll never know. But in retrospect, better him than me. Marky slid the key into the keyhole, turned it, and entered. Alone. A peculiarity of our room was the light switch. It was clear over on the other side from the entry, near Miss Norwood's desk. Our building was cobbled together over many, many years through gradual accretions. Certain things no longer made any sense, but were too expensive to repair or renovate. The light switch situation was one example. As soon as Marky tiptoed into the darkened room, we knew something was wrong. Each footfall came with an accompanying a kind of a crutch. Sounded like he was walking on popcorn, or maybe broken glass. Halfway there, he faltered.
"Miss Norwood?"
"Go on, Marky, don't be afraid of the dark. You're almost there."
She was furthest away from the door, being a good shepherd to her main flock. So Marky continued. We began to venture in behind him. He was not to the lights yet. And now, everyone's step repeated Markey's. The sound was satisfying, but what was it? Maybe it was popcorn. Maybe Miss Norwood had a huge store of it.
Maybe it's going to be a party. Kids began to jump up and down. They were all screaming, "Popcorn, popcorn, we're going to have a popcorn party. Oh, popcorn, oh boy, oh boy."
Boy, were we keyed up. Boy, were we wrong.
Markey finally flicked on the overhead fluorescents. Their harsh glare illuminated the tiny, ravenous bodies of thousands and thousands of praying mantises. Or is it manti? This was the riddle of my weedy show-and-tell item, unriddled at last. Later, we learned that a single praying mantis chrysalis houses up to 500 of nature's fearsome predators. Generously, I had gifted the class with 50 such little gray egg sacs. Since the window shelf was also the location of our heat register, they had been perfectly incubated. 25,000 of them had emerged to welcome us back. And they were everywhere. They were on the ceiling. They were on those fluorescent light tubes. They were inside the heating registers, from which they continued to emerge for weeks. They were in our desks. They were on the coat rack. Oh, and yes, they were on the floor, too, in uncountable numbers, hence that crunch, crunch, crunch beneath our feet. And, buddy, they were hungry. For anything. They weren't quite starving. Evidently, they'd been eating each other for several days. But a change in diet is a welcome thing. So they tried to eat us. Tiny manti launched their tiny selves from the coat rack. Others merely released their grip on the ceiling and fell down onto their victims. They couldn't actually do much harm to an adult human, but we weren't adults. And in a few seconds, we no longer sounded human. Predictably, we screamed bloody murder as loudly as we could, all the while racing around the room in abject terror. We were like a herd of cats with their tails all tied together. You didn't want to stick your hand in there.
Tinkle, tinkle, tinkle.
Miss Norwood's voice. She tried to calm us. But for once, her magic balm failed to work. We were a three-alarm fire with no water in sight. Praying manti entangled in girls' hair. Some found their way down the backs of blouses and shirts. With a particularly arresting screech, Markey hiked at his underwear and leaped about like a human pogo stick. The entire class witnessed the location of his trouble and his reaction to it. Real or imagined, suddenly we all suffered similar attacks in the same place. Kids rolled on the floor, gripping their crotches. Unintelligible gibberish filled the air. A holy roller preacher could not have wished for more. 26 miscreants all speaking in tongues at the same time, as it were. Meanwhile, far down the hallway, but not so far away as to miss the uproar, Mr. Noble's ears pricked up. Who dared raise such a noise in his school? And right after he had given the warning pronouncement, he was a mad bull set loose, a shark following the scent of blood. He stormed down the hall. Perhaps momentary surprise registered in his brain as he noted that the sound was coming from Miss Norwood's room. But his ire was complete. He was unstoppable. Well, he was mostly unstoppable, because when he entered our room at a near gallop, his slick-bottomed black leather dress shoes began to slide in the now considerable pool of gooey praying mantis guts. We'd been flailing around for about 5 minutes now, so the pond of guts was pretty extensive. I suspect Mr. Noble was not a skater. Balance didn't look to be his thing. He went down with a nasty thud. Guts coated the fancy shoes. When he stood back up, we saw that the backside of his pants had an equal helping smeared over them, too. It seemed like a bad moment to mention this, so no one did.
Who is responsible for this?
His eyes looked menacing and bloodshot. His muscles were as knotted as I'd ever seen.
Of course, we kids all knew each other pretty well by now. It had been a long, hard semester picking our way through the intricacies of Dick and Jane and the 100 numbers on the poster board. We had bonded. Immediately, therefore, everyone turned, pointed at me, and said, "He did it."
Faster than human sight could follow, Mr. Noble appeared beside my desk. Somehow, I found myself dangling in mid-air.
hanging perilously close to his reddening face. Praying mantis guts stained the collar of his white shirt. For some reason, I couldn't keep my eyes off it. His eyes followed mine. He wiped off a finger's worth of that offending ooze and held it in my face, his other hand holding me aloft like so much meat.
"Did you do this?"
He waved the gooey digit under my nose. If there was any other way to end all of our shouting, I can't imagine what it was. Perhaps only Mr. Noble's unique entrance and his anger could have accomplished that deed. At any rate, even kids with still-living praying mantis on their arms and legs fell silent, and they looked up, eager to see what would happen next. At the time, I thought even the praying mantis seemed to get still and watch.
"Well, did you?"
Once again, I found myself called upon to speak in public. I was not enthused. Once again, the little speech technician who lived in my head offered me the usual phrase, "I don't know."
"You don't know."
Strictly speaking, that was true. I strongly suspected I was the root of the problem, but at that exact moment, I didn't know that for a fact. Only later, when the class looked up praying mantis in Collier's Encyclopedia, did we know for sure. I decided to do what Miss Norwood had taught us. I generously gave myself the benefit of the doubt. Maybe not. Adults will tell you it's best to tell the truth, and usually that's correct. But it is not always correct. Not in certain survival situations. This was one of those situations. Mr. Noble's lip began to quiver in a way I'd only seen done in movies. Something bad usually happened right after that. I waited for what it might be. What else was I going to do? That's when a stunning sound shocked us all into sudden immobility.
"Put that child down!"
Every one of us turned, Mr. Noble included, though he did not put me down.
"Put that child down, I tell you, he's done nothing wrong."
We were so stricken with wonder, you could have whacked us in the head with shovels and we'd never even have noticed the sound, the voice, was coming from Miss Norwood.
"He's done nothing wrong. All of this is part of a science experiment."
Chrome Dome looked at me suspiciously.
"Is this true?"
I hesitated. It seemed like it could be true, and it definitely seemed like it should be true.
"Yeah,"
I said.
"That's what it is. It's a science experiment."
It turned out that Miss Norwood had two voices. One, the sweet trickle of magic water and tinkling bells that worked so well. That was the one we knew and loved. But she'd been an army brat as a kid. She learned to imitate a whole slew of master sergeants in 6 different countries before she was 12 years old. She only used that voice for special occasions. I was eternally grateful she found the current occasion special. Shocked into near insensibility, as we all were, Mr. Noble lowered me down to the floor. I always thought of the look on his face when, much later, I learned the expression, "look like a deer in the headlights." Oh, it was a beautiful thing to see. He turned around and left our room. And you know, he never came back in our room again for the rest of the school year. True to form, Miss Noble didn't miss a beat.
"Tinkle, tinkle, isn't this great? Let's see which row can capture the most praying mantises. Row 1, you're first. Ready, set, go!"
How could any kid alive resist walking through the portal to her room and to learning and to your very own future every day, with anything less than a smile on your face? The answer is, you couldn't. So here's a short little coda to this story. Years later, at a school reunion, sitting at a table with classmates I scarcely recognized anymore, someone pointed out a tiny elderly woman at a distant table. Frizzy gray hair, floral print dress, slight stoop. Unmistakably, it was Miss Norwood. I walked over and introduced myself. I mentioned I was in her class in 1958. Did she remember me?
"Tinkle, tinkle."
Her eyes were dimmed, but her voice was the same.
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid not. That was my very first year of teaching. So long ago. I've been retired for many years, you know. You all were so little then, and Oh, you look so different now. Oh, what's your name, honey?
Juan Bob Sander.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I don't remember that name. What did you go on to do with your life all this time?
We chatted for a while. She was polite, but I could tell she was getting tired. I started to make my goodbye. Suddenly, she stared at me rather intently.
Just a minute. I want to ask you a question. Did you ever go by Bobby rather than Bob?
Well, I did. Up until probably fourth grade, I guess.
Oh, I thought so. Bobby Sander. Now I remember you. Weren't you and I involved in a science experiment?
I told her we were indeed, and we recalled the whole praying mantis invasion from beginning to end.
That day was so valuable,
she said.
I found out that catastrophes are especially good times to learn. And now you've given me a better way to remember my students, recall their nicknames, ask them for their nicknames. Would you sit with me some more and we'll make a game of it? I'll point to someone and you can tell me what they used to be called, their nickname.
Oh, yeah. She was definitely one of the good ones.